Hi, everyone, and welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe-Gazette for this Tuesday, September the 20th, 2022, as read to you here on the morning, airing the morning of Wednesday, September 21st. Hope you're having a great start to your day. This is your reader, Andrew Halp, here taking a look at the forecast here for the Mason City area as we are expecting a cooler day, much cooler for today. Overcast conditions, a high of just 67 degrees as compared to that hot one we had yesterday with a high right around 91 degrees. Expect those winds from the north and northwest up to 20 miles per hour for today. And then for your overnight, expect a low down at 43 degrees. Brr! Very low chances of precipitation, but partly cloudy skies out there is what we're looking at. And then for tomorrow, even colder, high 62 for your Thursday. And then Friday, about a 50% chance of rain, a high of 58 degrees, of just 58 degrees for your first full day of fall in this year, 2022. Wow, has it gone fast or what? Well, let's take a look at those headlines here on the e-edition of the Mason City Globe-Gazette. In the Tuesday edition here, we have high schoolers catching some waves. Expedition class gets basics of river surfing on a whitewater course. Story by Abby Koch. Also, Community Health Marks anniversary drive-through root beer floats to be offered Friday afternoon. And then Britain and world mourn queen. Thousands pay their respects to the monarch who defined an era. So these stories and more will start it off first, though, here in the reading of the Mason City Globe-Gazette with high schoolers catch some waves. Expedition class gets basics of river surfing on whitewater course. It was all smiles and waves for Charles City High School students on Friday. Rob Pittman's expeditions class had the chance to learn the basics of river surfing on the whitewater course in town. It is just one of many adventures students have with outdoor learning. Almost every single kid has told me, I want to do this again, Mr. Pittman, and that's what I wanted. I wanted people getting excited and wanting to come out here and do different things, said Pittman. Pittman and his fellow teachers learned how to river surf this summer from local instructors. Those lessons taught him the basics. Gear is available to anyone from the Charles City Parks and Recreation Department. When the school year started back up, he told his students about river surfing. It was kind of surprising because it's closer to fall, so it seems really cold. I had never heard of river surfing before, only like surfing, said senior Tawny Ebel. The expeditions class, an elective credit, is designed to get kids to turn off technology and turn toward nature for learning. That's according to Pittman. Other outdoor learning opportunities include exploring the local state park, rock climbing, and learning how to build shelters. 24 expedition students had the chance to take part in river surfing, with half learning the basics one day and the other half the next. Those who chose to opt out and were still involved with the river, cleaning up litter along the banks and removing brush. Everyone in the class is participating in this in some way, shape, or form, Pittman said. Charles City Parks and Recreation provided the equipment. A lifeguard was on duty, and several experienced river surfing community members were there to teach the kids. The class geared up in helmets and life jackets to enter the water with their boards. One by one, the beginner surfers would paddle out to try to catch the sweet spot where the water would carry them. To do surfing, you have to be able to swim. You have to go down the river correctly, and you have to basically be able to go from your belly to your knees to standing up, and you have to know how to fall off the board, said Pittman. It was like a water slide, but one where you actually have to be in one place in the water, and the slide just keeps on going, said Ebel. Well, the class kids who started to find their confidence on the board as time went on and tried surfing on their knees or standing. Fellow classmates and Pittman would cheer loudly when someone found success. I knew that because they did it. I knew they had encouraging words. If they could do it, then everyone else could do it, Ebel said. Pittman hopes to see more of the whitewater course by young members of the community and more river surfing on it. He has written three different grant applications for more surfing equipment to one day create town event out of the activity. He hopes to receive $7,000 in grant funds. I have kids that are of a higher socioeconomic background all the way to kids that are in need of assistance. To be able to get those grants, I can make this an opportunity for everyone, and that's my big goal. I want equity in sports, said Pittman. In addition to getting the students outdoors, getting kids out of their comfort zone is another goal. With this experience, I would 100% do it again. I want Pittman to find more things for us to do because I actually want to try and do this in my future as a hobby, Ebel said. Well, their safety net is what they can and can't do, said Pittman. The more that you have little challenges, the better off they're going to be. I just want to give them challenges in a control area that will help them grow as people. All right, in other news, besides hanging out on the river, Community Health Mark's anniversary. Drive-through root beer floats are to be offered Friday afternoon. Another story by Abby Koch of the Globe Gazette. The Community Health Center of Mason City will celebrate its four-year anniversary on Friday, September 30th. The organization will be serving free root beer floats to the public from 2 to 4 p.m. that day by drive-through in their parking lot. We are celebrating with our patients and staff who also are welcoming anyone who would like to come and learn more about our services, said CEO Renee Kruckenberg. The Community Health Center of Mason City opened its doors on October 1, 2018, and offers medical, dental, and behavioral health services all under one roof. They have played a role in providing rapid COVID-19 testing in the community over the last couple of years. The health center, which did a complete renovation of the building located at 404 North Federal Avenue in Mason City, accepts insured, underinsured, and uninsured patients. They have a sliding fee scale based on income and household size for those that qualify, according to a press release. In addition, they accept Medicaid, Medicare, and most private insurance. We have a long history of providing comprehensive, accessible health care for all. We also staff a financial advocate to assist patients and non-patients with obtaining insurance, Kruckenberg said. From there, we move on to our last front page story. This written by Danica Kirka, Mike Corder, and Simia Kulab. It's from the Associated Press. Britain and world mourn queen. Thousands pay their respects to monarch who defined an era. And the photo shows a mugshot of Queen Elizabeth II smiling. She looks very happy in that photo. Dateline London, where the United Kingdom and the world bade farewell to Queen Elizabeth II on Monday with a state funeral that drew presidents and kings, princes and prime ministers and crowds in the streets of London and at Windsor Castle to honor a monarch whose 70-year reign defined an age. In a country known for pomp and pageantry, the first state funeral since Winston Churchill's was filled with spectacle. Before the service, a bell tolled 96 times, once a minute for each year of Elizabeth's life. Then 142 Royal Navy sailors, used the ropes to draw the gun carriage carrying her flag-draped coffin to Westminster Abbey, where pallbearers carried it inside, and about 2,000 people ranging from world leaders to healthcare workers gathered to mourn. The trappings of state and monarchy abounded. The coffin was draped with the royal standard, and atop it was the imperial state crown, sparkling with almost 3,000 diamonds, and the sovereign's orb and scepter. But the personal was also present. The coffin was followed into the church by generations of Elizabeth's descendants, including King Charles III, heir to the throne, Prince William, and 9-year-old George, who is second in line. On a wreath atop the coffin, a handwritten note read, "In loving and devoted memory." It was signed Charles R. for Rex, or King. Here, where Queen Elizabeth was married and crowned, we gather from across the nation, from the Commonwealth, and from the nations of the world to mourn our loss, to remember her in long life of selfless service, and ensure confidence to commit her to the mercy of God, our Maker and Redeemer, the Dean of the Medieval Abbey, David Hoyle, told the mourners. The service ended with 2 minutes of silence observed across the United Kingdom, after which the attendees sang the national anthem, now titled God Save the King. The day began early when the doors of Parliament's 900-year-old Westminster Hall were closed to mourners after hundreds of thousands had filed in front of her coffin. Monday was declared a public holiday in honor of Elizabeth, who died September 8th, and hundreds of thousands of people descended on central London to witness history. They jammed sidewalks to watch the coffin wend its way through the streets of the capital after the service. As the procession passed Buckingham Palace, the Queen's official residence in the city, staff stood outside, some bowing and curtsying. Mark Elliott, age 53, who traveled from the Lake District in northern England with his wife and two children to watch the procession, got up at 1:30 a.m. to stake out a good viewing location near the palace. "I don't know the Queen, but she's been our head of state for 70 years. You feel as though you know her. You feel as though she's part of the family. It is kind of moving," he said. Archbishop of Canterbury Justin Welby said in his sermon at Westminster Abbey that few leaders receive the outpouring of love we have seen for the Queen. More people lined the route the hearse took from the capital to Windsor Castle, and many tossed flowers at the cortege as it passed. Millions more tuned into the funeral live, and crowds flocked to parks and public spaces across the UK to watch it on screens. Even the Google Doodle turned a respectful black for the day. As the coffin arrived at the castle, there were poignant reminders of her love of animals. A groom stood at the roadside with one of her ponies, Emma, and another member of staff held the leashes of two of her beloved corgis, Sandy and Muke. During the committal ceremony in St. George's Chapel on the castle grounds, Dean of Windsor David Connor praised Elizabeth for her life of unstinting service to the nation, but also her kindness, concern, and reassuring care for her family and friends and neighbors. Then the crown and the orb and scepter were removed from the top of the coffin placed on the altar, separating them from the Queen for the last time. Her coffin was lowered into the royal vault through an opening in the chapel's floor. Charles looked weary and emotional as mourners sang the national anthem. At a private family service, the Queen was later laid to rest with her husband, Prince Philip. The mourners at Westminster Abbey included Joe Biden, French President Emmanuel Macron, all of the living former British prime ministers, and European royalty. In Japan, whose Emperor Naruhito also attended, several people sipped beer and watched the service at the Aldgate British pub in Tokyo's fashionable Shibuya district. The Queen had an especially long history in a country that boasts a long history, and so she deserves deep respect, said one of them, Tomoto Taka Hasokawa. The global outpouring of sympathy touched the King, who on the eve of the funeral issued a message of thanks to people in the UK and around the world, saying he and his wife, Camilla, the Queen Consort, have been moved beyond measure by the large numbers of people who have turned out to pay their respects. One more short story here about that subject here on page A3. Queen reunited with Prince Philip, parents on Windsor Castle grounds. That's written by Sylvia Huey of the Associated Press and Dateline London. After the pomp and pageantry of a grand state funeral, Queen Elizabeth II was laid to rest in an intimate ceremony away from prying cameras at Windsor, where she was reunited with her late husband and her parents. King Charles III and senior royal family members will gather for late Monday's interment ceremony at St. George's Chapel, a Gothic church on the grounds of Windsor Castle that has seen royal weddings, christenings, and burials since the 15th century. The chapel is the resting place of 10 former British monarchs, including Henry VIII and the beheaded Charles I. Elizabeth II's parents, King George VI and Queen Elizabeth, were interred there along with the ashes of Princess Margaret, the late monarch's younger sister. The chapel is also the home of the Order of the Garter, an ancient order of chivalry founded by King Edward III in 1348. Last year, the Queen bid farewell to her beloved husband, 99-year-old Prince Philip, at St. George's in a COVID-secure funeral. The ceremony to mark the death of Philip, the Queen's husband of 73 years, was muted because of strict pandemic restrictions, and only 30 mourners were allowed inside the chapel at the time. On Monday evening, the Queen's coffin was to be interred together with Philip's remains at the King George VI Memorial Chapel and an annex within St. George's. St. George's in Windsor featured prominently throughout the Queen's life. The chapel was where she marked many a Christmas and Easter and where she celebrated the weddings of three of her grandchildren. Prince Harry married Meghan Markle there in 2018, as did Princess Eugenie and Jack Brooksbank. Peter Phillips, the Queen's oldest grandchild, married Autumn Kelly there in 2008. The Queen spent most of her weekends in Windsor, a quiet and more private retreat away from the bustle of Buckingham Palace in central London. All right, in other news, we move to page A2 here in the Mason City Globe Gazette. Harvest gets underway in much of Iowa. Dateline Des Moines from the Globe Gazette staff. Widespread rainfall across the state resulted in 5.8 days suitable for fieldwork during the week ending Sunday, according to the USDA National Agricultural Statistics Service. Row crop harvesting has begun, and other fieldwork including chopping silage, cutting hay, and seeding cover crops. Producers were also preparing equipment and bins for harvest. Despite widespread rainfall over the weekend, we anticipate unseasonably warm and dry weather will continue through the end of September, setting up ideal conditions as harvest activities ramp up, said Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Mike Negg. As we recognize National Farm Safety and Health Week this week, I want to encourage Iowans to keep safety on the roads and in the fields atop of mind this harvest season. Topsoil moisture conditions rated 14% of the five-year average. 42% of Iowa's corn crop was mature, 2 days behind last year, but equal to the average. Harvest of the state's corn crop began with 2% complete. Corn condition was 64% good to excellent. 75% of soybeans were coloring or beyond, 3 days behind last year. Soybeans dropping leaves were at 30%, almost 1 week behind last year and 3 days behind the five-year average. Soybean conditions remain 63% good to excellent. 94% of the state's third cutting of alfalfa hay was complete. Pasture condition rose slightly to 34% good to excellent. Some producers have livestock on dry lots due to lack of water in pastures. And here's a quick weather summary. Unseasonably warm temperatures held on through the last full week of summer, with positive departures approaching 6 degrees in northwestern Iowa. The statewide average temperature was 67.6 degrees, 4.2 degrees above normal. Widespread and beneficial rains fell over southern Iowa, with some severe thunderstorms producing pockets of large hail and high winds. So ends that story. Moving on now to County Conservation notes campground closing dates. And the photo here at the top shows the Cerro Gordo County Conservation Board offers three campgrounds. And in the foreground is a lake or pond that is smooth. There are no waves really at the time. And in the background, tents and campers can be seen amidst trees and green grass. The story by Abby Koch of the Globe Gazette. Cerro Gordo County Conservation Campground's changes are coming soon. Effective Wednesday, September 28th, all Cerro Gordo County Conservation modern campground shower house facilities and public water sources will be closed. According to a press release, this is because of their current public water supply permit. Electricity will still be available and fees will be reduced to $10 a night. Portable toilet will be placed at each shower house, and the dump stations will remain open. On Monday, October 31st at 8 a.m., the campgrounds will close for the season. All units must be removed by then. This includes Wilkinson Pioneer Park in Rock Falls, Lynn Grove Park in Rockwell, and Inga Bretson Park in Thornton. The three campgrounds will reopen in May of 2023. Recreational experience close to home brochures of year-round activities within the county recreation areas and other areas are available by calling 641-423-5309 or by visiting www.cgcounty.org/departments/conservation or stopping at the Lime Creek Nature Center Monday through Friday from 7:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. And then from there we go to a very short story. Campaign signs must be on private property. That's written by Abby Koch of the Globe Gazette. Cerro Gordo County Auditor's office would like to remind people where they can place campaign signs. Campaign signs are permitted on private property but are prohibited on city parking and county road right-of-way, according to a press release. Signs in violation may be removed by the appropriate engineering department or law enforcement authority. People with questions can contact the Iowa Ethics and Campaign Disclosure Board. Their website is www.iowa.gov/ethics or call 515-281-4028. All right, moving on now to more news on page A3. Well, Iowa consumer challenges Beyond Meat's protein claims. It's written by Clark Kaufman of the Iowa Capital Dispatch and airing here in the Mason City Globe Gazette. An Iowa woman is among three consumers suing the markets of Beyond Meat for what they allege are false claims about the protein content of the meat substitute. It's the third such lawsuit filed against the company in recent months. The lawsuit, filed in the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Iowa, seeks class action status and unspecified damages from Beyond Meat, Inc. Named as plaintiffs are Erica Nichols Cooks of Des Moines, Richard Garcia of Denver, Colorado, and Jennifer Spear of Pensacola, Florida. Cooks alleges she purchased Beyond Ground Beef and Beyond Sausage, as well as other Beyond Meat products, at retailers such as Target, Hy-Vee, and Walgreens throughout 2022. She alleges that although the products were more expensive than competing brands, she bought them in part because the labels promoted a specific amount of protein content. All those representations pertaining to the protein content were false, the lawsuit claims. Garcia's and Spears' allegations are of a similar nature. The lawsuit claims that Beyond Meat's claims of protein content are inflated due to its deviation from the accepted government-approved method of calculating protein and each product's daily value, which reflects each product's percentage of the recommended daily intake of protein. The Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetics Act requires food manufacturers to use a specific set of calculations intended to show the amount of digestible protein in a product. Beyond Meat allegedly uses a different method of calculating protein called the nitrogen content method. While FDA rules allow that, they also require a different set of calculations in arriving at a daily value percentage. According to the lawsuit, Beyond Meat does not adhere to those government-imposed industry standards, and as a result, its product labels do not reflect their actual protein content. As one example, the lawsuit states that while Beyond Beef's sausage plant-based dinner links claims to provide 16 grams of protein per serving and 25% of the daily value for protein, the links actually have 13 grams of protein and only 5% of the daily value. Simply put, the lawsuit states, Beyond Meat's product labels are a farce. Defendant knowingly prepared the material on their website and product labels to misrepresent the true protein amount. The lawsuit alleges violations of various state consumer fraud laws, as well as violations of the federal Magnuson-Moss Warranty Act, which provides consumers with a legal cause of action for breach of warranty. The lawsuit also alleges unjust enrichment. It is at least the third class action lawsuit to be levied against Beyond Meat this year, the others having been filed in Illinois and California. The California lawsuit takes issue not only with Beyond Meat's protein claims, but with the company's claim that all natural ingredients, pointing to the use of methyl cellulose, which the law claims is synthetic. Beyond Meat has said the allegations of falsely stated protein levels are unfounded and not representative of Beyond Meat's products, and indicated it will vigorously fight such allegations. In the Iowa case, the court has yet to rule on the plaintiff's request for class action status, and Beyond Meat has not filed a formal response to the lawsuit. Moving on now to news from page A4. Tropical weather, Fiona slams Caribbean. Still recovering from Maria, much of Puerto Rico is without power. This written by Mary Carmen Rivera Sanchez and Danica Cotto of the Associated Press, Dateline San Juan, Puerto Rico, where Hurricane Fiona unleashed more rain on Puerto Rico on Monday, a day after the storm knocked out power and water to most of the island, and National Guard troops were rescued hundreds of people who got stranded. The governor warned that it could take days to get the lights back on. The blow from Fiona was made more devastating because Puerto Rico has yet to recover from Hurricane Maria, which killed nearly 3,000 people and destroyed the power grid in 2017. 5 years later, more than 3,000 homes on the island are still covered by blue tarps. The storm stripped pavement from roads, tore off roofs, and sent torrents pouring into homes. It also took out a bridge and flooded two airports. Authorities reported one death from the hurricane, a man swept away by a flooded river in the inland town of Camarillo. Puerto Rico officials said it was too early to know the full scope of the damage. The storm was still expected to dump up to 15 inches of rain in some places as it spun away from the U.S. territory that is home to 3.2 million people. One death was associated with the blackout, a 70-year-old man who was burned to death after he tried to fill his generator with gasoline while it was running, officials said. Governor Pedro Pierluisi declined to say how long it would take to fully restore electricity, but he said for most customers it would be a question of days. Meanwhile, in the Dominican Republic, authorities closed ports and beaches and told most people to stay home from work. The government reported one death from falling trees. Nearly 800 people were evacuated to safer locations, and more than 700 were in shelters, officials said. The hurricane left several highways blocked, and a tourist pier in the town of Mijes was badly damaged by high waves. At least four international airports were closed, officials said. Back in Puerto Rico, the National Weather Service office said flash flooding was occurring in south-central parts of the island and tweeted, "Move to higher ground immediately," all in capital letters. Up to 22 inches of rain fell in some areas of Puerto Rico, and forecasters said another 4 to 8 inches could fall as the storm moves away, with even more possible in some places. "It's important people understand that this is not over," said Ernesto Morales, a Weather Service meteorologist in San Juan. He said flooding reached historic levels with authorities evacuating or rescuing hundreds of people across Puerto Rico. "The damages that we are seeing are catastrophic," Pierluisi said. Now some briefs from the digest section, here on page A4 of the Mason City Globe Gazette. Strong earthquake shakes Mexico. Dateline Mexico City. A magnitude 7.6 earthquake shook Mexico's central Pacific coast on Monday, killing at least one person and setting off a seismic alarm in the rattled capital on the anniversary of two earlier devastating quakes. There were at least some early reports of damage to buildings from the quake, which hit at 1:05 p.m. local time, according to the U.S. Geologic Survey, which had initially put the magnitude at 7.5. It said the quake was centered 23 miles southeast of Aquila, near the boundary of Colima and Michoacán states, and at a depth of 9.4 miles. President Andre Manuel López Obrador said via Twitter that one person was killed in the port city of Manzanillo, Colima, when a wall at a mall collapsed. Next up, U.S. aircraft carrier heads to South Korea, Seoul, South Korea, where a U.S. aircraft carrier will visit South Korea this week for its first joint training with South Korean warships in 5 years, officials said Monday, in an apparent show of force against increasing North Korean nuclear threats. The USS Ronald Reagan aircraft carrier and its battle group will arrive at a southeastern South Korean naval base on Friday for a combined training meant to boost the allies' military readiness and to show the firm resolve by the Korea-U.S. alliance for the sake of peace and stability on the Korean Peninsula, the South Korean Navy said in a statement. It would be the first such joint drills involving a U.S. aircraft carrier near the peninsula since 2017, when the U.S. sent three aircraft carriers, including the Reagan, for naval drills with South Korea in response to North Korean nuclear and missile tests, according to the South Korean Defense Ministry. Other brief news, power sources. A dozen environmental groups are starting legal challenges against the European Union's executive branch in a bid to stop the inclusion of natural gas and nuclear power generation in the bloc's list of sustainable activities. European Union lawmakers in July voted to add natural gas and nuclear to the list, backing a proposal from the European Commission that has been drawing fierce criticism and accusations of greenwashing. And we are about at the halfway point here. You are listening to the Mason City Globe Gazette on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard here on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. This is Andrew Haupt, your reader, filling in for today. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, then please give us a call at 515-243-6833 here in the office and let us know. or that toll-free number from anywhere across the state of Iowa, 1-877-404-4747. And now let's take a look at the obituaries here in the Mason City Globe-Gazette for the Tuesday, September 20th edition. First off, we go to Idona Schott, who lived from December 26, 1915 to September 17, 2022. She was 106 years old. Dateline Mason City, where Idona Schott passed away after a well-lived life. She died Saturday, September 17th at the Good Shepherd Healthcare Center in Mason City. A funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, September 23rd at the Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel at 126 3rd Street Northeast in Mason City, with Pastor Dan Garrett of Trinity Lutheran Church officiating. Burial will be held in Brush Point Cemetery in Hanlontown, Iowa. The family suggests memorials for Grace Lutheran Church of Hanlontown, Iowa, or Trinity Lutheran Church of Mason City in honor of Idona's wishes. Idona Aurel Gesme was born on December 26, 1915 in Worth County, Iowa. The daughter of Henry and Sophie, maiden name Story Gesme, she attended school at Hanlontown and Waldorf College, graduating in 1934. She then taught 2 years in a rural one-room school. Idona married Dewey Schott on March 24, 1937, and together they farmed north of Hanlontown until Dewey's death in 1967. Idona moved to Mason City and was active in her church and various charities. For years, Idona found old dolls at garage sales and thrift stores. She restored the dolls by cleaning and dressing them in handmade clothes. They were then donated to Grateful Children in Mississippi at Christmas time. Idona also made many quilts and crocheted numerous afghans. She loved to share old-time memories with family and friends. Those left to cherish memories of Idona are her nieces and nephews, Luther, married to Kay Gesme, Gary, married to Arlene Gesme, Russell, married to Jane Gesby, Kay, married to Jim Murphy, and Jan Rauch, as well as numerous members of Dewey's family, extended relatives, and friends. Idona is preceded in death by her husband Dewey, her parents Henry and Sophie, brothers Lawrence, Selmer, and Stanley, as well as her niece Deborah Britz. The Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel is in charge of arrangements, can be reached at colonialchapels.com. Next up, we go to Irene M. Casperson of Clear Lake. Irene M. Casperson, age 89, of Clear Lake, died peacefully at home surrounded by her loving family on Saturday, September 17th. A memorial mass will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Thursday, September 22nd, 2022 at St. Patrick's Catholic Church located at 1001 9th Avenue, Clear Lake, with the Reverend Josh Link officiating. Graveside services will take place Thursday at 1:30 p.m. at the Sacred Heart Catholic Cemetery in Rockwell, Iowa. A memorial visitation will be held at Ward Van Slyke Colonial Chapel, 310 1st Avenue, Clear Lake, on Wednesday, September 21st, from 4:30 to 6:30 p.m., followed by a rosary service and scriptural wake service at 6:30 p.m. In lieu of flowers, please consider a donation to North Iowa Hospice or St. Patrick's Catholic Church of Clear Lake. Irene was born in Rockwell, Iowa, on October 14, 1932, to William Bill and Sadie Engels D. Rock, the second of five daughters. She met Leon Casperson while attending Owen No. 9 Country School when she was in fourth grade and he was in seventh grade. Irene graduated from Sacred Heart School Academy in Rockwell and upon graduation went to work for Mason City Bell Telephone Company as a switch operator. She married Leon Casperson on January 12, 1952 and had just recently celebrated their 70th wedding anniversary. They were blessed with six children. Irene was a devoted farmer's wife who always made sure that whoever was working in the fields during planting or harvest season was well fed with a hearty noon meal and coffee and sweets throughout the day. In addition to raising six children, she was always willing to do whatever it took to keep the farm running, unless it was on a Friday. Friday was hair day. She would drive to Mason City and have her hair done and do the weekly grocery shopping alone. God help the person or the event that interfered with her Friday hair days. She actively served her church, St. John's of Cartersville, and later Sacred Heart Catholic Church of Rockwell. She also served on the board of the YSS Francis Lauer Youth Home in Mason City. She and Leon spent 26 years wintering in Mesa, Arizona, where they met many snowbirds like themselves that resulted in many wonderful lifelong friends from all over the country and Canada. She is survived by her husband, Leon, her children and their spouses, Janice, married to Tim Foley, Mike married to Jeanette Casperson. Mary Kay married to Randy Pierce. David Casperson. Teresa married to Randy Thomas. And Angela married to John Scarless. Her 12 grandchildren, 6 great-grandchildren. Her 2 sisters, Marilyn married to Bob Ermer. And Diane married to Aaron Salling. And her aunt, Grace Lonergan. She was preceded in death by her parents and her sisters, Dorothy Cahill and Shirley Rise. The Ward Van Slyke Colonial Chapel is in charge of arrangements. Can be reached at www.colonialchapels.com. And then next up in our final obituary here, listed is 4. Carolyn Kincaid Sullivan, who passed away September 14th. Carolyn Kincaid Sullivan, age 86, died Wednesday, September 14th in Plattsburgh, Missouri. She was married to Richard Sullivan, former city editor of the Mason City Globe-Gazette. They lived several years in Mason City where they raised 4 children. She was preceded in death by her parents, her husband, and her son-in-law, Mark Gard. She is survived by her 4 children, Steve, Sally Gard, Rick married to Marnie, and Michael. 4 grandchildren, Jordan, Brittany, Harry, and Madeline. And 4 great-grandchildren, Landon, Brendan, Lux, and Milo. All right, it's that time. That means it's time that we take a look at sports as obituaries are done. We go first off to Iowa State football. McDonald eyes Big 12's all-time sacks record. The Cyclones edge rusher 3 away from former A&M star Miller's mark. This written by Rob Gray, special to the Globe-Gazette. Dateline Ames, where by the time Iowa State sacks king Will McDonald reached the interview room, he'd already forgotten the specifics of his first sack of the season. Forgive him. McDonald's second-half quarterback takedown during an excruciatingly long but relatively stress-free 43-10 win Saturday over Ohio won't pop off the screen during film study. It was his 30th career sack, placing him just 3 behind future NFL Hall of Famer Von Miller on the Big 12's all-time chart. So no, the 6'3", 236-pound All-American doesn't focus on single sacks. His eyes are locked on the top prize. I am trying to beat the sack record, said McDonald, who totaled 22 sacks the past 2 seasons. Miller set the Big 12's benchmark in that statistic 15 years ago. McDonald plans for his to hold up in perpetuity if he's able to eke out at least 4 more sacks this season while providing the Cyclones with a 3-0 record, even more versatility than he's had in the past. I'm able to be comfortable in any position, said McDonald, who hopes to help ISU improve to 4-0 for the first time in 22 years after Saturday's 11 a.m. conference home opener against number 17 Baylor. Whatever position they put me in, I feel like I'd be most comfortable in it because I do know most of the defense and what everybody's doing. He played on the edge as usual. He's played nose guard and at 3 technique. He's even played a bit of safety for a Cyclone defense that ranks 8th nationally in total defense. That's 234.3 yards per game. And McDonald is convinced he can do even more to help his team. If I did have the chance to do everything, like even play quarterback, I definitely would, McDonald said. Just having that ability to do things, it's just a blessing to have. Big things, wide-ranging things, sometimes overlooked things. The sacks, those are just stats in my opinion, ISU head coach Matt Campbell said. I really feel if you look at his game last week against Iowa, man, he's all over the film. Played fantastic. Graded out as excellent the last 2 weeks. So great statistically that he gets that. But other than that, I really feel like he's played great football for us. That's not all the talented redshirt senior from Waukesha, Wisconsin has done. McDonald is on track to become the first in his family to earn a college degree. And sandwiched within sacks talk, he was asked what mattered more to him, breaking the Big 12 record or obtaining his diploma. I'd probably say graduating, McDonald said. So that's just one big thing I want to prove to everybody that I can do. McDonald finally decided to play football late high school after first shining on the basketball floor. He initially resisted, but eventually relented, and now he's considered to be one of the top edge rushers in next year's NFL draft. The football coach would always come chasing after me and say, just come out, come play football, McDonald recalled. I'd always say, no, I don't really want to. Then finally, I went out my junior year, and it's just developed from there. So he's happy to be chasing sacks records instead of trailing fast breaks for soaring dunks, mostly, sort of, still. If I had a chance to play basketball and football at the same time, McDonald said, grinning, I definitely would. Well, from there we go to Iowa football. Hawkeye defense continues to impress. This next story, written by Steve Batterson of the Quad City Times, but airing here in the Mason City Globe Gazette. Five takeaways from the shutout over Nevada in the nearly seven-hour game. Dateline Iowa City, where five things to think about following the Iowa football team's 27-0 victory over Nevada at Kinnick Stadium are listed as follows. Number one, the really good. Whenever a defense is able to shut out an opponent, savor it. In today's college football, holding an opponent without a point is a rare occurrence. Iowa's shutout of Nevada was the Hawkeyes' first since winning the 20-0 at Northwestern in 2019, the first at Kinnick Stadium since a 30-0 win over Rutgers earlier that same season, and just the sixth in 129 games Iowa has played since Phil Parker became the program's defensive coordinator in 2012. It's what we work for, said defensive back Cooper DeJean, who had his second interception in as many games. You don't want to give up any points in any game, and when it happens, it means that each person is doing their job. We still have things to work on and fix for the next game, but to the shutout is important. Number two, the consistently good. Jack Campbell continues to be good at football. The middle linebacker had a game-high 10 tackles for Iowa, the second time this season and the seventh time for Cedar Falls, for the Cedar Falls Iowa native, that he has recorded a double-digit tackle total. Campbell moved from 79th to 68th on Iowa's career tackle charts Saturday, topping the 200-tackle plateau with his second stop. He now has 208 tackles in his college career. His work Saturday helped limit Nevada to 69 rushing yards and 1.9 yards per carry. Number three, the good. True freshman Drew Stevens and sophomore Aaron Blom split kicking duties in Iowa's first two games, but Stevens took on all kicking duties in the Nevada win. The North Augusta, South Carolina native delivered and connected on the first two field goal tries of his career, hitting from 43 to 33 yards, connected on three pat kicks, in addition to driving five of his six kickoffs into the end zone. Blom was one of three in field goals tries throughout two games. Iowa coach Kirk Ferentz said Stevens was told Friday by special teams coordinator LeVar Woods that he would be the starter. The guys have been going back and forth, and I've been saying all along that we're probably going to ride the roller coaster a little bit, Ferentz said. We're really pleased with both guys and Aaron. You haven't seen the last of him. We have two good kickers right now, and hopefully they can get comfortable. From there, we move on to number four, the not so bad. The bar had been set low, but it was a day of season highs for the Iowa offense. The Hawkeyes compiled a season best 337 yards of offense as they moved to 2-1, having their best efforts of the season with 162 rushing yards and 175 passing yards. Quarterback Spencer Petras spread the ball around, hitting seven different receivers, and hit Arlen Bruce the fourth with a 21-yard scoring pass, Iowa's first touchdown pass of the year. Caleb Johnson had Iowa's first 100-yard rushing effort of the season, gaining 103 and helping the Hawkeyes average a season-best 4.6 yards per carry. The whole offensive unit together, it just felt cohesive, and I think everything just clicked today, Bruce said. It just felt really good to be out there. It was fun. And then finally, number five, the ugly skies. With its three weather delays totaling 3 hours, 56 minutes, Saturday's second half was a stop-and-go affair. Play was halted from 8:36 until 9:56 p.m. when the teams returned to action for 9 minutes before lightning prompted a second delay at 10:05 p.m. The next snap came at 11:55 p.m. when Nevada quarterback Shane Illingworth, who completed 14 of 28 passes for 82 yards, threw an incomplete screen pass on a 3rd-and-22 play as lightning lit up the sky again and sent the teams off the field at 11:57 p.m. It was a long, long mental battle, DeJean said. Obviously, we were just sitting in the locker room for a while, but we all had to stay focused, stay locked in, and finish the job we started. Lightning cleared the area, and the teams resumed play at 12:43 a.m. on Sunday, completing the game. And the photo at the right shows Iowa wide receiver Arlen Bruce IV celebrating a touchdown with Iowa quarterback Carson May during the first quarter of a college football game Saturday that happened on Saturday the 17th at Kinnick Stadium. Well, this is a local story. Indians and Lions combined for 9 wins at weekend tournament. And we're the prep roundup section here on page 1B, written by Zach Martin of the Globe Gazette. Forest City's volleyball team literally pulled a reversal. Clear Lake has won at least 4 matches in its second straight weekend tournament. Of the 7 area teams that the Indians hosted on Saturday morning, the Lions and Forest City put its best foot forward. 1 weekend after going 0-5 at Osage, the Indians went a perfect 5-0 on their home floor, and Clear Lake posted a 4-1 record at the Forest City Invitational. Lake Mills posted 3 finals online, going 2-1. St. Ansgar and Central Springs also won twice, while Newman Catholic and Hampton Dumont Cal went winless in its matches published online. Forest City, 10-5, swept the Spencer HD Cal and Roland Story schools. It lost the first set against Algona and Webster City before tying the match and eventually triumphing in 3 sets both times. The Indians have 1 more tournament sandwiched between the top of Iowa West contest before facing Lake Mills at home for a potential conference title match. Jaden Jerome had a stat-filled tournament with 42 digs, 36 kills, and 21 assists for Forest City. Jalen Hovanga recorded 30 kills, 29 assists, 22 digs, and 8 service aces. Bethany Warren chipped in 22 kills on the day, and Emma Anderson had 36 digs in the back row. Clear Lake matched its season win total from last year with 11. It still has 4 more North Central Conference matches and 2 more weekend tournaments. The Lions defeated Newman Catholic, Algona, and St. Ansgar in straight sets and pulled out a 3-set thriller over Webster City. They fell to Lake Mills in 2 sets. Zeta Johnson paced Clear Lake's front row with a tournament total of 37 kills, while Hannah Blaha recorded 22 kills. Macy Hulk finished with 24 assists combined over the victories against Webster City and Algona. Class 2A number 14 Lake Mills and Newman Catholic did not have stats published from its 3 matches. Central Springs swept Hampton Dumont Cal and Newman Catholic convincingly, but fell to Clarion Goldfield Dalles in straight sets and dropped 3 set matches against Roland Story and St. Ansgar. Zary McDonough distributed 79 assists and Casey Crum slammed down 40 kills. Carly Ryan and Quinn Smith each paced the back row with 32 and 29 digs, respectively. Abby Pate posted a tournament double-double with 13 kills and 18 digs. St. Ansgar's other win on Saturday also was in 3 sets as it triumphed over Algona. The Saints were swept by Clarion Goldfield Dalles and Roland Story, as well as the aforementioned setback to Clear Lake. Addison Tabbert and Madison Hillman each recorded 30-plus kills at the net, while Kinsey Anderson paced the back row with 47 digs throughout the tournament. Aspen Falk dished out 76 assists, and her and Tabbert combined for 10 aces. HD Cal, to go along with its losses to Forest City and Central Springs, also fell in straight sets to Spencer and NCC rival Algona, plus lost in 3 sets to Newman Catholic. Aubrey Showalter finished with 21 kills and 21 digs on the tournament, while Abigail Dreyer and Zoe Erdman recorded 25 and 24 digs, respectively. Aubrey Groenwald dished out 34 assists on the day. In volleyball, Mason City finishes 2-2 at weekend tournament. The Riverhawks played 4 matches at the Janesville tournament on Saturday and swept the host Wildcats and Iowa Falls Alden, but were swept by Class 3A No. 5 Union and Grundy Center. The 2 victories for Mason City, 8-7, were polar opposites. It cruised by the Cadets, 21-13 and 21-9, then staved off Janesville in a 22-20, 21-18 thriller. Union and Grundy Center took control of the matches versus the Riverhawks and won in straight sets. Megan Tobin led Mason City with 22 kills for the tournament, and Ellie Cotta recorded 16. Brandy Tilkis and Ella Turk each were perfect from the service line with 2 combined aces, while Turk recorded 52 aces in the 4 matches. Riceville goes winless in the tournament. The Wildcats were swept by Waukon and lost a three-set heartbreaker against Turkey Valley on Saturday morning at the Waukon Invite. After dropping the first set versus the Trojans, Riceville, 7-9, rebounded and won the second set 21-17 to force a deciding third set. Turkey Valley had just enough to push to win 15-8 and take the match. No stats for the Wildcats in either match were published online. Osage picks up three ranked wins. The Class 3A number 9 Green Devils continued their winning ways against top 15 opponents as they swept three of them at the Dyke New Hartford tournament on Saturday. The only team Osage couldn't beat was the host Wolverines. Dyke New Hartford, one of the best teams in the country and the top-ranked team in 2A, won in straight sets both meetings. The Green Devils swept 2A number 9 Sumner Fredericksburg, 4A number 14 Humboldt, and 1A number 14 Dunkerton. Only stats for Osage published online were the two setbacks against the Wolverines. Sydney Muller, Samantha Brandow, and Jaden Francis each had double-digit digs numbers in the two matches. Muller had 13 total assists, and Claudia Ashenbrenner had 7 total kills. West Fork records one win in Nashua. The Warhawks were on the verge of suffering three straight matches of getting swept before they rallied past South Winnesheek and won in three sets at the Nashua Plainfield Tournament on Saturday. It was the only win of the day for West Fork as it lost to the host Huskies and Clayton Ridge in straight sets. Kinsey Lambertson, Kaylee Lunt, and Ellie Weaver each posted at least 5 digs in the back row. Mallory Meyer recorded 7 kills over the three matches, and Emma Martinik chipped in 6. From there we go to golf. River Hawks finish top 10 in Marshalltown. Mason City fired a team score of 352 at Friday's Joe August Invite, held at Elmwood Country to tie for 9th with Ottumwa. Indianola, with 3 in the top 10, won the team title with 296. Southeast Polk paced my tourney medalist Landon Van Erms, 68, was 2nd with a 301. Norwalk had 304. Ankeny Centennial 309 and Marshalltown 315, rounding out the top 5. The Riverhawks were led by freshman Michael Solberg Moss with an 80, tying him for 20th on the individual leaderboard. Drew DeGabriel carded an 85 to finish inside the top 30. Noah Hahn, 93, and Brendan Berkeley, 94, were Mason City's final two scorers. Again, that written by Zach Martin, who is a sports reporter for the Globe Gazette, can be reached via email at Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, .Martin, M-A-R-T-I-N, at GlobeGazette.com. And from there, we go to more short stories in the digest on page A4 in the Mason City Globe Gazette, Dateline Myanmar. Government helicopters attacked a school and village Friday in north-central Myanmar, killing at least 13 people, including 7 children, a school administrator and an aid worker said Monday. Lunar Rover, the United Arab Emirates, will launch its first lunar rover in November, the mission manager said Monday. Hamad al-Marzouki told the national, a state-linked newspaper, that the Rashid rover, named for Dubai's ruling family, would be launched from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida sometime between November 9th and 15th. From there we go to Taiwan, where about 400 tourists who were stranded on a mountainside when a strong earthquake hit Taiwan have descended safely as the island on Monday repaired damage caused by the 6.8 magnitude quake which hit on Sunday afternoon. And then finally from California, a major storm that battered western Alaska over the weekend churned through northern California on Monday after bringing early season snow to the mountains and dropping rain that helped firefighters increase their containment of the 119-square-mile mosquito fire in the Sierra Nevada foothills northeast of Sacramento. In another brief news, U.S. traffic deaths dip in quarter two but are still high. Fatalities spiked after the start of the pandemic when roads emptied. This written by Tom Krischer and Hope Yen of the Associated Press, Dateline Detroit. The number of people killed on U.S. roads fell slightly from April through June, the first decline in 2 years as pandemic-era reckless driving appeared to ease. But the government said the number of deaths remains at a crisis level. Estimates from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration show that 20,175 people died in crashes from January through June, a 0.5% increase over the same period last year. Yet the second quarter decline ended a string of seven straight quarterly increases that began in the summer of 2020 with the onset of the coronavirus pandemic. The agency estimated that 10,590 people died this year on roadways from April to June, nearly 5% fewer than the same period a year ago. The NHTSA Acting Administrator Ann Carlson told a group of state safety officials Monday that she hopes the recent decline is the beginning of a downward trend, but that the number of deaths remains unacceptable. "That is not the new normal we want," she told the Governor's Highway Safety Association. "Fatalities began to rise 2 years ago when the roads were largely empty due to stay-at-home orders in many states. With less traffic, speeds increased, as did reckless and impaired driving, leading to a record spike in deaths last year. Many people weren't wearing seatbelts," the government said. And that's about all the time we have for this episode of the Mason City Globe-Gazette. This is the Tuesday, September 20th edition, is brought to you on Wednesday morning, September the 21st. Thank you so much for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. This has been your reader at the microphone filling in. My name is Andrew Haupt. We're so glad to have you listening. If you have questions on this or any other program we have, check out our website, iowaradioreading.org, or give us a call at 515-243-6833 or toll-free from anywhere in the state, 1-877-404-4747. We thank you so much for listening. Have a great day, everyone, and straight ahead.